Welcome back to the podcast series on how to improve elections from the Electoral Integrity Project. The COVID-19 pandemic presented a huge challenge to electoral officials, policymakers, and stakeholders for running elections. Just as the pandemic came to an end in 2023, the Electoral Integrity Project published a book in collaboration with International IDEA, bringing together the lessons from the pandemic for future emergency situations. Now, this is a joint podcast from International IDEA and the Electoral Integrity Project involving a discussion about the key lessons from the book. And it was introduced and chaired by Therese Pierce-Landella.
Hello and welcome to this joint International IDEA and Electoral Integrity Project podcast episode on elections during times of crises, hosted by me, Therese Pierce-Landella. And today I'm speaking to the authors of a giant new tome, a great big book brought out by International IDEA and the Electoral Integrity Project. And it is called Elections During Emergencies and Crises: Lessons for Electoral Integrity from the COVID-19 Pandemic. And I'm speaking to the lead authors, Professor Toby James from the University of East Anglia, also co-director of the Electoral Integrity Project. Welcome, Toby.
Hi there.
And we've got Professor Alistair Clark from Newcastle University. Welcome, Alistair.
Morning, Therese. Morning, everyone. And thanks very much for organising this discussion.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. And last but not least, my very dear colleague here from the Electoral Processes team at International IDEA, Eric Asplund.
Thank you, Therese, and thank you for hosting.
So this book, which I have in front of me, includes 8 thematic chapters, very comprehensive ones about the experiences from COVID, and 26 case studies that of particular elections that it went through the COVID experience. And it was recently launched at the Swiss Parliament. And so for our conversation today, I was thinking that we could touch on the main messages or findings from each of the thematic chapters, if that works for all of you. And I actually wanted to start with one that's that I remember vividly. It brings me back, reading this chapter, to March of 2020, when here at International IDEA, the first question that started to come in and took us by surprise, we weren't prepared for it, was, should elections, scheduled elections, be postponed or not? And we had to think really, really quickly on our feet. We didn't have much experience. There was Ebola in Liberia. And there were possibly some natural hazards or some extreme weather events. But there wasn't much global experience for us to pull from. So we had to think very, very quickly. And now I hope in hindsight that we've got a lot more that we can say about postponements, when it's appropriate, why it's appropriate. And I thought I'd start with you, Toby, to give us a bit of a summary of what we might have learned about postponing elections from this the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, no, thank you, Therese. I mean, it really does take us back to the beginning, doesn't it, of the pandemic? And that was, I think, the question that many policymakers and electoral administrators were wondering back in that time. I think particularly here in the UK, that was a pressing question ahead of local elections, but also in France as well. And, you know, in terms of what eventually happened, I mean, it was really historic, actually. I think we established that 80 countries and territories postponed their elections in the 2-year period that kind of followed. And that really was sort of unprecedented in sort of the history of elections, really. So, I mean, do we know now whether it's fair and right to postpone an election? I think it can be, and I think there's a humanitarian case for postponing an election. And ultimately, you know, what are the purpose of elections? They are to enable democracy, and one of the things democracy is supposed to be doing is to protecting and improving human life. So clearly, I think if running an election is going to threaten people's lives, then there is a humanitarian case for postponement. But I think one of the things that really kind of came clear is that there was a bit of a muddle around the world in terms of whether countries had some clear procedures in place for this. Some countries did, and others really didn't have the legal kind of mechanisms in place for this. And what kind of therefore followed was a lot of disputes and confusion about whether it would be fair to postpone an election. So I think probably the key lesson here going forward is maybe some kind of clarity in terms of electoral rules or constitutional rules about what are the conditions under which an election can be postponed, and who can make those decisions. And really crucially, I think, to encourage more kind of cross-party and collective decision-making on that, because I think where countries ran into problems was where, you know, small groups of people were making those decisions, and it leads to those concerns that maybe they're doing it to make sure that a particular party or candidate will be advantaged.
I think, Toby, you've touched on a couple of really, really interesting points, and that is that this conversation is well held before a crisis happens, and that the conversation crosses party lines and also includes those who will be administering and also the politicians and also the legal experts who know what is possible and not possible, or what legal changes need to be had. And one thing you didn't mention, but perhaps is important to add, which is when is it possible to postpone, but also what tracks it back again? Like, when do you have to hold it again? And so that kind of sunset clause about when that runs out. Eric, you've been tracking postponements really from the first week. You were very, very quick to open up a special website that just tracked who was postponing and giving information basically a la minute. Do you have anything to add from what the global picture that Toby just presented?
Thanks, Therese. Well, I mean, there was a few things that we did notice. One was that, there was a couple of patterns. One was that national elections were less frequently postponed compared to subnational elections. Also, we did notice that there was a lot of variation in the length of those delays. Countries like Kiribati had a very short delay, only like 7 days, where Hong Kong had a delay of more than 400 days. On top of that, I mean, it is also good to mention here that although we did see many elections that were postponed, more than 100 in these 80 countries, most of them were subsequently held. One of the reasons why there may have been a discussion about postponements, it goes back to what Toby mentioned earlier. I mean, we did see some evidence of widespread consultations about postponing. I think Argentina was a good example of this, right? And but then there were other countries who took a more of a unilateral approach. This could be the case, for example, in the United Kingdom. Now, problems were often experienced as a result of the absence of clear legal provisions for election postponements. But I think this could go, not only in the UK, but in also other countries. I think South Africa was a good example. France is another example, but also maybe Canada.
Excellent. And one of the reasons, of course, for postponing was the worry that elections would spread COVID. And I thought I'd just jump to one of the later chapters and ask the questions, did elections spread COVID? This was very top of mind, and everybody was watching. I remember the French local elections, and in particular, the counting of the elections and the COVID that spread. But in hindsight, what can we say about whether elections did spread COVID? Alistair, what are your reflections on this?
I think it's a very mixed picture, Therese, and I don't think we have evidence that points in one particular direction, unfortunately. I mean, it's very difficult from where we are now to actually remember back to those days of February and March 2020 and the pressures that administrators were under, because they had no idea how this virus actually spread. There were thoughts about it being spread by surfaces and touch, and it was only latterly that the idea that it was an airborne virus really, you know, took root, and that became the explanation for how it was spread. And of course, what you had immediately, you had some countries running elections. You've mentioned the French municipal elections, and there are also municipal elections at the time in Bavaria, and so on. Elections happening in the United States, elections happening all over the world. And those who were running them were really having to take snap decisions on the basis of very little evidence, and on the basis of evidence that was itself a moving picture, because it's not just that spread was occurring, but populations were also really moderating their behaviour because of the threat, which is one of the reasons that it's so difficult to say that elections did actually spread COVID, because people were actually staying at home. You know, we were seeing postponed elections we've talked about, but those that we've just mentioned, well, there were lower turnouts in the French municipal elections in the second round. Bavaria pivoted very quickly to all postal voting in its second round. Some studies, however, have shown that there were fairly significant effects. Some studies showing that was in terms of contagion. Other studies going on to talk about mortality. Having said that, I think one of the difficulties that studies have found is that there's been no consistent way of measuring the effect of COVID-19. They all use something different. Do they use mortality? Well, some of the studies that were conducted around elections do. Others use infection rates. Others use hospitalization rates. They use different periods of time. Some use 2 weeks after the election as a cutoff point. Others use a month after the election for cutoff points. So there are different methodologies. And this means that we end up with evidence pointing in different directions. Now, some of the findings have been quite spectacular, really. There was one paper which posited around 30,000 infections and around 750 deaths from a range of Trump rallies in the United States, in-person rallies held in the United States, which are quite spectacular figures for spread. But then when you go to look at other countries, other ways of measuring this, then you know that just doesn't come through into the findings, the level of spread. So I think it's a very mixed picture that we found in terms of the evidence here. What I think we can fairly safely say is that when contagion levels were fairly low in an area, the findings seemed to be that it was less likely to actually be a driver of the spread of COVID-19 running an election. But where contagion was already high in a particular jurisdiction, then an election could actually go on to encourage that spread even further. So it all depended very much where the country was beginning from. And we did have one discussion at one point with a policymaker who suggested actually the best time to run elections in terms of minimising spread was just after a lockdown had been released, because at that point, the virus was at its lowest ebb and less likely to encourage spread. But a very, very mixed picture, unfortunately.
Two very interesting things from what you've said, Alistair, that I just want to pick up on. And one is this idea of in some ways segregating, I don't know if that's the right word, but just doing some kind of an analysis where here it's okay and there it's not. And this is a very complex thing to navigate, but has been done in the past, for example, in India, for example, with if there's violence in certain areas and so forth, that there's a bit of staggering going on. And so I think that there are lessons there for the future as well. If there's it could be about violence, but it's also going to be increasingly the case with extreme weather events that they might affect one part of a jurisdiction, but not another, especially in a large country. So I think that's a very interesting lesson to take forward. But another one is just the moral dilemma for the electoral authorities, in that your mandate is to provide the franchise, and that is extraordinarily important. But what if you put someone at risk? And here I just want to give one small anecdote that makes this very personal. The first election that I worked on was the post-conflict election in Cambodia, post-war. And the area was very, very heavily mined, where I was a district electoral supervisor. And people were very, very excited about voting. And one of the polling, one of the voters on his way to the polling station stepped on a personnel mine and lost his foot. And it sticks with me even to this day. Like I just, you know, have a visceral response. And somehow the anecdotes that you were just saying about that possible spread, like just to have that feeling of responsibility. And I know that many were grappling with that, with those choices that they had to take. So I think that's one thing we need to think about also, is just the moral toll on those making these kinds of decisions about recruitment, about training, about how to hold, so not just voters, but also how to keep your staff safe. And I think, Toby, this is something that you know a lot about as well. So I just wonder if you've got anything to add on this topic of the spread. Toby.
No, I think that kind of covers things really, really nicely. I mean, I guess one important theme there is that comes across the areas is implementing procedures on the ground. So we can design practices to keep people safe, but then actually ensuring that these procedures are kind of enforced on the ground is a very different scenario. So I think, as Alice is saying, the campaigns were one of the areas potentially with the greatest kind of spreader of COVID, but maybe you could campaign safely, but actually campaigning, organizing a rally is very difficult to actually kind of regulate. And obviously, of course, campaigns take different forms in different countries as well. So some countries campaigning might involve putting leaflets through doors, and that's, you know, relatively safe in terms of COVID terms. But when you're bringing big groups of people together to organise a rally and a campaign, that's really an important part of the electoral process. Then it's a very different situation and becomes very different, very difficult to kind of regulate. So I think developing these policies is one thing, but then actually finding a way of actually implementing them on the ground is, and as you say, that responsibility and where responsibility lies is something very, very, very different altogether.
It's interesting that you brought up campaigns, because the thing about campaigns, as I remember it in the various elections globally that we were watching, is that on the one hand, there were health decisions to be taken, but on the other hand, these had extraordinary political implications. And so any decision that you took was seen to benefit somebody and not benefit somebody. So it became quite conflictual in that sense. And here, I'm just wondering, Alistair and Eric, if you've got more to add on this issue of campaigns, because you looked at it closely. Maybe I'll start with you, Alistair.
I think campaigns were different depending where on in the world you were. I mean, in advanced democracies, there's this notion somehow that we've been heading towards a data-driven campaign environment, for instance, with things moving online. Whereas in less advanced democracies, then, you know, the sense is that mobilization, rallies, in-person events were very much more important. That's a dichotomy. I mean, in-person events are still obviously useful in advanced democracies as well. And there's plenty of evidence of limitations in all types of democracies upon the big in-person event. I think the question really is the extent to which these in-person events were limited, and some form of in-person mixing and campaigning was permitted. In some countries, that just really wasn't permitted. Actually, in the United Kingdom, the door-to-door canvassing was stopped in the run-up to the 2021 elections. But that wasn't the case elsewhere, where events such as door-to-door canvassing went ahead with small teams, sometimes of up to about five, maintaining social distancing and so on. What I think we did see more of were those large events actually being restricted, big rallies and things of this sort. And I think for good reason. I mean, to come back to one of your earlier points, Therese, one of the things we really didn't have in places was good data on the spread of the virus in the first place, enough to make decisions about specific campaign events and so on. So these end up being blanket bans. But what we end up seeing, and again, that Trump report on campaign rallies, I think, is instructive here. The potential for, you know, where there is a high level of spread, you know, significant consequences. That estimated, I think, was up to about 30,000 infections, 750 deaths, and not only of those who attended the rallies, but in people they'd met and passed it on to as well. What I think was interesting in some ways is the fact that in some places this may well have given online modes of campaigning a bit of a boost for going forward. I think we still need research on this to find the extent to which the pandemic has boosted that mode of campaigning, because another lesson that I took from all of this is that political parties across the world are very, very devoted to the campaign methods that they've consistently used in the past. And there was resistance to changing campaign methods as a result of the pandemic. So campaign organisations, I think, showed up the small c conservatism in changing their methods in terms of campaigning during the pandemic, I would suggest.
That's an interesting observation. And I think some of the newer parties have been quicker at adopting this social media trends. And in many ways, when we talk about COVID, we say that it accelerated trends that were already underway. And certainly there was a trend towards campaigning using social media and TikTok and others. This was also the case for voting, that it accelerated trends. But I wonder, Eric, if you could speak first to campaigns, and then we'll talk about the changes to voting that were perhaps accelerated because of the pandemic.
Absolutely. On social media, sure. I mean, these shifts were already underway. But I agree that the pandemic kind of helped to accelerate this shift in campaigning. A couple of good examples would be Singapore. Parties started, you know, discussing their plans through e-rallies on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Also in the US, ahead of the November 2020 presidential election, if you remember, both the Republican and the Democratic Party made use of social media and even held their party conventions online. That was quite something. But I just want to make one more point about campaigns before we move forward. Now, I mean, it's already been mentioned, but I think it's important to emphasize that roughly half of the, I think it was more than 100 countries we were looking at, saw limitations on traditional campaigning because of government restrictions on movement and public gatherings. Now, restrictions, I mean, it included limits on the number of participants allowed to attend public gatherings and complete bans on political parties or events, limiting some freedoms of association and assembly during this period. Now, I think also here, it on kind of limiting freedoms of association and assembly during elections, there are some countries which used COVID as a pretext to clamp down on campaign activities organized by the opposition.
I think that's a very, very important lesson to take forward in terms of organizing elections in times of crises. And that is, are the measures that are taken to limit the franchise, the measures that are taken for the purpose of the health of the people or the safety of the people, are they truly for that purpose, or is there some kind of political motivation behind it? And I think that's very, very much something to watch out for, and something that would be really helpful if civil society watches out for too. And maybe we can touch on observation in a moment. But first, I want to get back to the point about voting. So we said that COVID accelerated some trends that were underway. And of course, polling stations is not a polling station is not an ideal situation if you want social distancing, to have so many people in one place on one day. And we saw rapid expansion of alternative ways of voting, or what we call special voting arrangements. Eric, can you give a bit of an overview of how that looks during COVID and what that might mean moving forward?
Sure. I mean, most of the around 130 countries that eventually had elections introduced health and safety guidelines and arrangements. I think that's in polling stations. First, I would like to make that point. Sometimes these guidelines were in many ways developed in collaboration with health authorities and other kind of stakeholders. To some extent, they covered different phases of an electoral cycle, but in particular, voting operations and kind of the setting up of polling stations. So this speaks to kind of the idea that this interagency collaboration, that this was kind of new in the extent that we saw election commissions now working with health authorities and health authorities had this scientific advisory role in terms of how elections could be held. And this brought with it, obviously, various health and safety measures on election day. So everything from social distancing to wearing masks, having gloves, using sanitizers, all of that stuff. But also in polling stations, they would have maybe special queues for certain people, primarily vulnerable people, dedicated entry points, exit points. So there was a lot happening in the polling station that you would not necessarily see, if it wasn't if the election wasn't happening during a pandemic. So that's number one. Another thing that we saw was special voting arrangements, such as early voting, mobile voting, proxy voting. They were all increasingly used during the pandemic period. I think the book demonstrates that those countries which had special voting arrangements in place already saw demand for them increasing. The demand increased substantially. Now, this was especially the case for postal voting. For example, in Canada, for the 2020 provincial elections in British Columbia, it was quite astonishing. They saw a rise in postal voting from close to 0%, 0.3 or something, to 31% compared to 2017. In the US, there was a major push for postal voting. 65 million citizens used voting by mail compared to 24 million in 2016. So the UK, but I'll let Alistair and Toby say more about the UK because they also saw the increase of volume in postal voting. Now, special voting mechanisms, I think, played an important role in preventing turnout decline during the pandemic. Also, not only postal voting, but I think other measures like mobile ballot box voting, proxy voting, it really helped to enfranchise people with COVID because there were many people who were infected and they didn't really have a way to go and vote safely on election day. So by providing or extending special voting arrangements, this really allowed the election authorities to give a give people with COVID a way to express their wishes
Thanks, Eric. And maybe this is a good point to make a plug for an upcoming handbook that we have on special voting arrangements, which goes through each of the types that Eric has just listed very thoroughly and where they could be appropriate. And that is coming out soon. Alistair and Toby, from what Eric has just said about both the health measures that were put in place in the polling stations, but also all of these alternative forms, what can you say about, two questions I want to ask is, did they influence turnout? What do the numbers actually say? And also, I'll just add another question onto that. This can't have been cheap to pivot so quickly. Who carried those costs and what implications does that have moving forward? None of this could have been foreseen of all the measures, both the expansion of special voting arrangements and all of the public health measures that were put in place. So I'll ask each of you, maybe I'll start with Toby and then Alistair, to reflect both on if this affected turnout. Was it effective? What went in basically is what we're saying. Did it work? And then what can we learn about that? And also that pivoting had a cost and how should we think about that moving forward? I'll start with you, Toby, and then I'll ask you to reflect, Alistair.
Brilliant questions, thank you. So, I mean, it is worth saying one of the questions at the start of the pandemic was, would turnout be affected by the pandemic? Because would this turn voters away? Maybe they would be a little bit scared about going to vote in conditions in which, you know, their health would be at risk. And the answer was yes. Overall, turnout did decline. So we identified an overall decline of 4.1% for national elections. Subnational elections, that was 6%. So yes, in emergency conditions, turnout can be affected, and that's something we really have to think about kind of going forward. And it's not just also at that kind of aggregate level, though, it's also at the individual level. I think as Eric alluded to there, there are some cases in some countries where procedures were put in place that prevented people leaving their homes out of health and safety measures, and therefore meant that they couldn't actually vote on election day. So we often use disenfranchisement, I think, as a concept very loosely, but this literally was disenfranchisement for some people. And I think even if they're not, you don't really see that in those aggregate figures, these were elections in which people could not vote because of their health. And that really sort of undermines, I think, some of the principles of democracy. Then, you know, what role then do special voting mechanisms play? And as Eric kind of suggests, there's lots of different mechanisms that were put in place: postal voting, sometimes proxy voting, mobile voting, early voting. So we did some of the statistical analysis to look at, well, which of these procedures made a difference, and if they were in place, did that actually lessen the reduction in turnout? And of those, it was postal voting that was the crucial one. That was the one where you could actually see a noticeable difference in terms of turnout. So the availability of postal voting for emergency conditions is really important. And I guess the other thing to flag in there, things that also came out through analysis, was also the length of the delay of the election. So if there was a long delay for the election, a long postponement, then turnout also kind of fell. So I think that's something to bear in mind, given that some countries kind of reorganize the election as soon as possible, others went, you know, let these kind of roll on for over a year. And then just in terms of the financing of all this, so obviously, you know, it sounds like postal voting is good, and all these other mechanisms are really important, I think, for enabling participation, particularly for some minority groups, in the case of these elections, those with underlying health conditions. So we did surveys of EMBs to look at, well, what were their costs? And 90% of the EMBs reported major increases in their costs. These were mostly to do with obvious things like, face shields and medical gloves and everything else that were necessary in particular for this. But there were also other hikes in prices related to hiring polling stations and related things. And I think this really shows quite a really important point about who is going to pay for this, because it's often the case that electoral administrators find themselves in situations where they're already perhaps at the kind of budget limit. And when you have a crisis, which doesn't necessarily have to be a pandemic, You know, many countries at the moment, for example, are seeing very large increases in inflation that all of a sudden hikes their costs, then making sure that the fundamentals of funding elections is really, really important, because there are some, there are actually some cases, I think the one in Jamaica, one in Australia, where elections weren't actually held, or they were not held at all at the local level because they wanted to save money. And that is literally democracy being denied on the basis of how much it costs. And that, I think, is really kind of problematic.
That is. And I just want to introduce also something that we saw that really touches on what you said, which was supply chain issues. You were talking about price hikes, and the supply chain problems were a part of that as well. So we should, as we remember back on COVID and implications for the future, this issue of supply chains was one. Alistair, your reflections?
It just really a couple of brief things to kind of draw out a couple of themes from what we found in this regard. The first is that there were very few just basically coming up with something brand new across countries. What countries tended to adopt depended on where they started from. In other words, what they had some degree of experience of using to begin with. So it was very rare that we saw a country just coming up with something new. One exception to that, I think, was the idea of drive-through voting, which I think we started to see in a number of countries, which I don't think any country had before. I may be wrong in that, but that seemed a new one. Anyhow, what they adopted depended on what they already had some degree of experience with. And the second theme or thing that Toby didn't really mention, but was that there's a dog that didn't bark in all of this. And the dog that didn't bark was arguments for online voting as a way of resolving potential crises in the future. There were plenty of arguments for online voting prior to the pandemic. They just seem to fade away during the pandemic for whatever reason. I'm not quite clear why that was the case. Obviously, limitations as to what could be done at speed in relation to online voting and speed during the pandemic was of great importance. But these arguments for online voting don't seem to have been given boosters by the pandemic.
That's very interesting. I had the pleasure of visiting Estonia during the recent elections, and they are very, very unique and an outlier in terms of getting over 50% of online voting. But I think both the Estonians themselves and those who look at the Estonian case very closely recognize that it's a very unique, special place with unique conditions and not something that can be easily transferred somewhere else, although forward-leaning and good to keep an eye on. So. Thank you all. Eric, I'll pass to you, and then we'll start. I'll pass to you in a moment and to reflect on what you've just heard. But I also want each of you, as we close up, to think about your favorite of the recommendations that we had in this book. So there were 11 recommendations clearly put out, but if you could each pick a favorite and perhaps add anything that you think we might have missed in the conversation so far. So Eric, I'll give you a chance to reflect on what Toby and Alistair have just said, but also if you could give me your favorite of the recommendations.
Thanks, Jess. I was just reflecting a little bit about remote electronic voting. It's a bit of a mixed bag, because I remember in Lithuania, for example, they introduced internet voting, but where they have a legal framework that now supports voting online. But they decided not to make use of it because, I mean, for good reasons, they felt that it needed to be tried and tested before any election, and simply didn't have enough time. Another example that kind of that comes to mind is in I think it was New South Wales in Australia, where they have online voting called iVote, and this system simply failed because it was designed for I believe 500,000 people, but it was used by much more than that. And as a result, the system failed, so which caused a huge headache, of course, for the election commission, and part of that election had to be held again. So, also, you were wondering about kind of one general recommendation. Okay. Well, I don't think we've talked much about communication and how important communication is. Really, from the onset, even when we're talking about postponing elections, this is something that has to be clearly communicated. If you're going to hold an election, you know, going back to postponing, you also have to be very clear as to why you're postponing an election and for how long. That's central. Also, I think communicating with the general public in terms of, okay, we're going to have an election during a pandemic. What are the measures that you can expect in the polling station, right? So you can expect that you need to social distance. You need to expect to wash your hands and so on. So all of that has to be very clearly communicated. On top of that, because we did see special voting arrangements, and many people decided to make use of these special voting arrangements, that also is something that the Election Commission has to work on. In the past, many of these special voting arrangements were used by only a small group of people. But as we discussed earlier, like postal voting was expanded to a large proportion of the U.S. public, right, and also in other countries, and the same goes for proxy voting. So this is really more about external communication and allowing the general public that they feel safe when they vote. Otherwise, you'll see a drop in turnout for sure.
I really appreciate that public communication messaging, and that's certainly one to take forward. Toby, what is yours that you would take forward?
I guess the big one is probably electoral risk management. I think I would encourage people thinking about emergency elections to take themselves right back to that moment at the start of the pandemic, where there was just huge uncertainty about what are we going to do? Why haven't we planned for this? Why didn't we think about this scenario? Why haven't we got these things in place? And I think one of the reasons why it's difficult for why countries didn't put in place postal voting, for example, or didn't move to internet voting or make some other major changes is that those changes involve a lot of work. They involve a lot of changes involving a lot of people. So you can't rush that process. So if you're going to make sure that you're ready for the next emergency situation, and sadly they will come in some form in an era of climate change and everything else, then I think going back to doing an assessment of whether your electoral system, whether the electoral machinery kind of fits and is ready for a future emergency is the key thing I kind of focus people's mind on, because there's a risk that we can think, oh, COVID's done. We haven't got to worry about this. This is for for the historians. But actually, there are lots of really applied lessons, and I'm not just plugging the book. I promise here that I think countries can put in place if we just assess whether we're ready again for the next emergency.
So, election. We've got public communication and election risk management as two of our key takeaways. And Alistair, what would you add to that?
I think there's a broader question about how elections are viewed as part of a country's infrastructure here. There have been debates around election administration being part of critical infrastructure, and I think this should, to some degree, frame this discussion. But for me, the one I think that stands out of our 11 interlinked recommendations is actually forging consensus, because if there's one thing I think that came out of some of these debates in countries is that some actors sought advantage. And I think the difficulty going forward is that there's often no real consensus about the best way forward in electoral reforms. And forging consensus in a crisis environment is probably even more difficult. It maybe gives opportunities, but it also gives problems for moving forward. So I think the forging consensus thing is absolutely crucial to get an accepted way forward, and importantly, an electoral process that will be accepted by everybody should there actually be a crisis.
That's gorgeous, Alistair. And your infrastructure point, your consensus point, and your acceptance of election point all speak to, in a way, a broader point of elections as part of a societal, it's not just transactional, but it is part of our societal fabric. And with that, I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing the lessons and findings from this extraordinary piece of work. And as we've seen from this discussion, the lessons are relevant well beyond the pandemic, and we've really learned a lot. We've learned that not only did trends underway accelerate, but that innovations that were brought in, whether it was interagency cooperation or contingency planning, those types of things that had to be brought in quickly because of the pandemic, they will be habits that will stay with electoral management moving forward and will be very useful for handling the many, many crises that are bound to hit us in the future. So with that, I would like to thank all three of you. And for our listeners, just a reminder that the link to the book is available in the show notes. And if you have any suggestions or recommendations, please feel free to contact us at elections@idea.int. We'll put that in the show notes as well. So thank you so much, Alistair, Toby, and Eric.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.